Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Welcome back to second hour of Amplify, talking about the book The World According to God, written by F.X. Cronin. And I imagine that means Francis Xavier, is that right?
That is.
Okay. Better known, it looks like, you go by Frank also. As I was saying at the close of the first hour of our program, there are beautiful passages at the end of each chapter that read like it's a book on spiritual formation. Let me just read another one. I could pick almost any of them as we begin the second hour. Seek God sincerely and with an open mind and heart. That's what we're talking about tonight. For God desires you to know with certainty and to experience the joy and confidence of truth. And you should seek not just with your mind or heart, but with every facet of your being, with every act, every behavior you can muster. Whether you pray to God or read about God, whether you strive to love others and give yourself to serve them, whether you are actively making the world a better place for those you encounter, or you are sitting back and gratefully appreciating the beauty and wonder of our world, remember, these are all ways to seek God. Just remember that more deliberately, remember that more deliberately, and you will realize it more definitively. And so you write around this particular time in your book that our knowledge is limited to some degree because we know about, if we knew about God fully, that would make us gods. It seems so self-evident. I never thought about it that way. Our knowledge is limited to some degree because we know about God would make, if we knew him fully, that would make us gods. And the question that is asked is, what is God really like? Is God a force or is a person? Who is God? What kind of God is God? Say a little bit about this particular part of your book.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last part.
What kind of God is God? Who is God and what kind of God is God? And you talk about force or mind. God is mind. God is being.
Well, and that's kind of one of the distinctions where, you know, if you're a deist, you believe that if there is a God, he may not even be a being, he could be a force. And the Catholic God, the Christian God, is the Judeo-Christian God is a being. He's a mind and a heart. He is the fullness of perfection in all ways that we can know, despite our limitedness. I mean, we're limited, therefore we can know in part. We can't really know him in full because we would be him, as you kind of stated already. But I think knowing about God is knowing him. And I think that's a key thing that sometimes gets lost. If when we study about God, or we can reason and prove that he exists, that's an opportunity to encounter him. He's a being who seeks our relation, a relationship with us, and knows that if we have that relationship, we will be more like him. I mean, he's a father. They're forever using that. It's more than a metaphor, but I'll just say metaphor for now, that he wants us to know that we're his sons and daughters. We're his offspring. He loves us more perfectly than even the best father or mother ever could. And he desires a relationship with us, not just that we be dutiful or follow all the obligatory things, but the obligatory things are ways in which that deeper relationship is manifest. Just like we see every day in our relationships with fellow fallen human beings. That's what he desires for us, is this deep and profound relationship that embraces all of our being, our minds, our hearts, our actions, you know, our head, heart, and hand, those kind of things. That's what he's after. Knowledge, is, whether it's philosophical knowledge or even knowledge of his world, is knowledge is never just information. If you know something about the world, even scientific things, you're knowing him. This is his handiwork. I had a professor once explain this, and he had a great way of putting it. He said, he asked us in class, what's the opposite of knowledge? And most of us pretty quickly said, ignorance. You know something or you don't.
Right.
And he said, well, now, what would be a Hebrew's way of looking at it? And we puzzled over that and said, you know, ignorance as well. And he said, no, that's not really how they see it. There would be the lack of information, but the opposite of knowledge for Hebrew, or one of their understandings of that, was estrangement, interpersonal distance, even rebellion, so that everything, our knowing, is a form of relationship and part of it. So whenever we learn about his creation or learn about how our minds work and how he's created our minds, we're experiencing him at the same moment.
And you write that if this divinity we call God is a force and not a mind, he would somehow have to be less than human, less than the beings he wrought.
Mm-hmm.
God could be a lower life form than we are. A godlike force would exercise no judgment, make no decisions. It could only act. It would simply be a blind, relentless, mindless power, acting as it is compelled without any conscious thought or decisions. If God is a mere force, then something had to cause this force to act. Our uncaused cause must be a mind capable of making decisions, of choosing, of willing things into existence, and in and of themselves without recourse to other causes or situational influences. A God who can't decide certainly isn't God. This force may be powerful and may exceed our comprehension, but it's not God. God must be self-aware. He must have a mind. He must decide. Otherwise, he isn't God. It's just that simple. It's just that certain. It's just that startling. Sorry to read that much, but I just want people to know how well your book reads. I mean, your answers are incredibly understandable as you explain theological, biblical concepts, but it's written so beautifully throughout, and I just like people to know that. And we have all been infected to varying degrees by the malady you point out known as modernity. What is that malady?
Well, I think part of modernity is the loss of the power of reason and rationality, and the almost exclusive emphasis on science only. With that goes other things get lost. Morality becomes lost. We walk around and people, I mean, that's a common bit of Western parlance nowadays, is that, you know, that's your morality, that's not mine. This leaves us open to a variety of things, homosexual marriage, abortion, all those kind of things come from the fact that I am the sole decider of whatever morality I choose to follow, and that's part of what modernity has led to, although it was a slow slide, and the recent last 70, 80 years, the slide has been more accelerated because a lot of the primary principles undergirding all of that had already slid away as well. We don't have ways of proving that things are moral because our reason is gone. If all we are is, which people believe, not so much in a direct way, but it's implicit in what they think and how they act, mm-hmm. that if we're just biochemical machines, then morality is irrelevant or normative. It's not factual or reality-based. And reason is one of the things that allows us to prove that. It's hard to prove relativism with reason because you're kind of using a tool you haven't explained or justified, but that's what happens. And so modernity is where we are in Western culture now. I would argue since probably the Reformation and certainly the Enlightenment, whereby we began to forsake or confine religion to the world of belief, not a functional part of fact and a dominant force in culture. I mean, religion now is kind of in the minority, in at least in America, and you know it wasn't always that way.
You, again, writing about faith, say a blind leap is not what our faith asks of us. Ours is an informed faith, a rational faith, a commonsensical faith, a faith built on God and on familiar aspects of the human experience, from love and reason to beauty and truth. Our faith asks us to press on toward the frontiers of what we can actually know. Here on the frontiers, there is a need for some faith, even in the smallest amount. Faith is necessary because we don't, and in fact can't, know everything. It shouldn't surprise us that exhaustive knowledge is beyond any of us. And so...
No,
go ahead.
It really shouldn't. I mean, exhaustive truth is beyond even collective humanity, let alone individual human beings. Exhaustive knowledge is the province of God. But there's a whole lot of knowledge to be had short of exhaustive. And that stuff is what we can have access to.
And discovering the one true religion does not require blind faith, but open eyes. Tell us then about the God who seeks us, communicates with us, and came and lived among us, even. Some people believe in God, but not everyone believes that he came to live among us.
Right, and this is, Jesus Christ, God himself, came and lived among us, became flesh, suffered, died, resurrected, went to heaven. Those are all, by and large, historical facts. I mean, people died for those kind of the historicity of those facts. This is a God who desires relationship, who desires it so much that he came and lived among us. And there's three chapters in the book that talk about this. One is Jesus in history, and then it's Jesus's message and Jesus's mission. That talk about why he's here and what that says about who God is. And this is the distinctive part about what makes the Catholic faith and the Christian faith the only possible faith that could be true. Other faiths believe that Jesus was a prophet or a good teacher, but only Christianity has held that Jesus was actually God incarnate. And for me, that particular fact and the living experience of knowing that in fullness, and I mean knowing not just as head knowledge, but being in relational knowledge, that drives everything. I mean, mm-hmm. if you know that, it doesn't mean you know all there is to know, but you have a huge part of what it takes to look at life and understand life and navigate life well and in a pleasing way, both to others and to God and God our Father.
In the chapter on matters of revelation, you write that to the modern mind, the idea of divine revelation seems far-fetched, beyond reasonable belief. The very idea of a God who communicates with us seems more than a little fantastic and primitive. It certainly can't be a serious and sound basis for religious belief, nor can it have a place in our modern world. On some level, the idea of divine revelation seems superstitious and silly. Why? And how would God talk with human beings? What relevance and purpose could these ancient and primitive messages have in our modern scientific world anyway? Tell us a little bit about what is meant by natural revelation.
Well, natural revelation, from as I'm using it or as I think about it, is what we can have access to about who God is through our reason, through life experiences, through our common sense, through our intuitive sense of morality and ultimately, I guess, cosmology. I mean, we can see all of this and we can know this. So the Bible talks about this in Romans, where men are without excuse. They have enough knowledge to know something about God, even most rudimentary things. I mean, there are like native tribes that were undiscovered, and they had a sense of some greater being. You know, there's just this intuitive side that we can know. Our rational perceptions can tell us some things. Again, we can know a great deal once we start using reason and our common sense to come to a sense of who God is. Revelation supplements that. This is where God is talking directly rather than inferentially through his creation and through the way our minds work that he created. So I think that's how I would see it.
Right, and you were just touching on that in terms of supernatural revelation. You point mm-hmm. out is simply the name we give to God's communication with human beings, and it comes in two forms: the personal or private, and the general or public, and that mm-hmm. this personal experience of God is something we should seek and expect, that God invites us to know and love him, and he assures us of his divine love.
Right, and I mean, because he's a God who seeks relationship with us, we shouldn't be surprised that we have a private or a personal sense of who he is. On the other hand, you know, this is sometimes in the world of religion, we think our private revelations are somehow public revelations or take on that kind of level. And that's where kind of spirituality can run off the rails at times. But by and large, this is a God who seeks to be with us, to know us intimately, and wants us to know him in a similar manner. And what that, if you really grasp that or begin to experience that, it's a way of enlivening all of the other things we do in church and religiously. It makes them pregnant with meaning and with immediacy, our encounter with him routinely.
You point out that God knows what we know and therefore will judge us accordingly. That can be very consoling and hopeful, or could be very frightening, I guess, in some sense. We're going to be taking our next break, but we're going to come back and talk about matters of the miraculous. You write that for many of us who have received the gift of faith, miracles provide another level of evidence for God's existence and his nature. They tell us he is active and near, and they reveal to us his plans and his priorities. But for those who are uncertain or uninformed about their faith, miracles often challenge long-held ideas about our world, our universe, and the presence and nature of God. Oh, I got a minute. I went out 1 minute early, so let me just read a little bit more of this. In the realm of the miraculous, ideas run right up against the reality of the physical world and the practicalities of daily living. This is where our very concept of reality is challenged, where implicit beliefs and materialism are revealed. And this is the one area that often reveals a belief in the holy mechanical nature of the universe and also its latent materialistic basis. It reveals the unspoken belief that the universe is only and completely physical matter and energy. That's it. And that is all there is. The book is The World According to God, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify with FX Cronin, Frank Cronin, Dr. Frank Cronin. Latest book, The World According to God. One of my lessons today is my sister cooks so well that I want to eat it all, you know? And you just can't sometimes. Just can't have it all. And that's the way this book is. It's 300 pages, but it's 300 pages of truth and so beautifully written. And there are like seven chapters left and I've got 20 minutes. I like to touch on each of them, but that's not going to happen. But the topics are Jesus in history, Jesus's message, Jesus's mission, matters of the church, matters of orthodoxy, matters of morality, matters of spirituality, and finally, the heart of all matters. And the last one is super, at least from my perspective. Each one of us, as you read this book, will find some particular area that is very attractive to you. It touches your heart and your spirit. And it's really intended so that you've really been reaching out to those who perhaps have walked away from the church. And a lot of that has happened in the events that have taken place in the world these days, and inviting them to come back. But they need to understand something of really the truth, the world according to God. Is that not true?
Well, I mean, if you look at it, and this is kind of what we've been kind of hitting on and off throughout the whole thing, the truth, whatever truth there is that we can know, is God, and he put it there. And part of it is the embodiment of who he is. The more truth we understand, the more we know him. The more we know him, the more we're open to understanding that knowing is not knowing about God, but actually knowing him. And so that kind of richness of the reality, it's not just a matter of belief and having the right answers, but in the having of those answers, you're having a relationship with God. You're coming to know him in a deep way. And because God seeks relationship, that's reciprocated. He will let himself be known. You will have a sense of more than just this is some kind of syllogistic truth, that this is him. I'm experiencing him as much as knowing about him. So I think that's kind of where I'm going with that, I think.
And I'd amplify on that from reading from your book. God reveals his truth and his nature to those who will simply seek. His desire is that we should know and love him generally and personally, specifically and deeply. And unless God reveals himself, we can't fully love him. For love is intimate disclosure. The very nature of love requires disclosure and intimacy, as is evident in our most intimate personal relationships. This is why God acts dramatically, but in a manner that doesn't overwhelm our free will. It's just that simple. And as you will find, as you contemplate the reality of our human free will, it's just that essential, just that deep, just that wondrous. And you write just a little bit later, his desire for intimacy with us is so great that he acts in time and in space and speaks in ways discernible to us imperfect beings. He makes his love physically and historically evident, even beyond these miracles of obvious intervention, providential guidance, revelation, and inspiration. For not only did God continually reach out to us in all these revelatory and miraculous ways, but he actually came to live among us. And you believe that perhaps his greatest miracle was the forgiveness of sins. Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's part of the way of uniting himself with us. I mean, he's a perfect God and we are flawed, and coming to know, giving us this forgiveness allows us to bridge that gap mend that relationship. And by giving us forgiveness, he allows us to draw even nearer to him. And you can see the parental side in this. You know, often even instinctually as parents, better it happened to me than happened to my child. Well, that instinct or that moral imperative that we sometimes feel as parents or imagine as parents is a reflection of him, and it's a reflection that doesn't quite comprehend or encompass the perfection of who God is, but it certainly is a strong intimation of what he feels towards us. It was how much, he even said it, Jesus said it, what greater love can any man have that he lay down his life for his brother or friend? That's what he has done, and he's done this for all times, and so that we can kind of bridge that gap that we created with our fallenness, because he's already taken care of it for us.
Right, and another very important point that you bring up in your book is that, again, the world according to God, that all of the other miracles that you've described in this book have to do with the physical, but sins pertain to the eternal. They transcend temporal life and space and time. And you write, that is why the most crucial part of Jesus's mission was to forgive sins, to make us heirs of the kingdom of God, to empower us to live more righteously and intimately with God as his children, to preserve the world from sin and error, and to share the good news of redemption and salvation with all people. For if Jesus was truly God and saved us from our sins, his death is no small matter. In fact, it is the hinge of history, the turning point of the human drama. Your words, amplifying them just a little bit.
Well, I mean, it's the fixing of the universe. Because we were, you know, Adam sinned and things are distorted, this is now the most significant thing that God has ever done short of creation. It's like for him to come and to pay the dues for all of those sins so that our relationship could be restored with him. Everything after that is somewhat different and much better. It's open to mankind, and it's God saying, I'm drawing near to you in a way that would have been difficult before, but now all you have to do is accept that forgiveness, and you can really draw near to me. You can be sons and daughters, the heirs of God, in a direct way. In Jewish times, the idea of God as father or as Abba, as daddy, was far too intimate that they would not have understood it. And this is what Jesus is telling us, that is part of our inheritance, because we are the children of redemption, the children he has forgiven, so that our relationship is deeper and richer than it would be even if we just knew about this. He's opened the doors for us to really engage him. His heart is there. All we have to do is make ourselves available and just seek him. That's all he says to do. Seek and you will find. And there's a way of phrasing that even in the original Greek, where in the present tense it's point continuous action. So another way to translate that is seek, keep seeking, and you'll find, keep finding.
Mm. The book is written. It's really your story in many ways, and all the issues you dealt with so wonderfully, and you're sharing that with us. And this is a book that I would put in people's hands. A lot of people that I know who have sort of walked away from the church, saying, "Well, they still believe in God, but don't see any real relevance for the church in today's world." How would you counter that particular a person who comes to you that way in terms of what authority the church might have? That might sometimes be the wrong word, but if we understand it, what authority does the church have?
Well, I mean, the church stands on the authority or the activity of Jesus Christ and of God. I think when people walk away, they often walk away for different reasons. And so I think hearing what they are, what what has caused them to fall away from the church. I mean, sometimes people confuse the behavior of the clergy in recent years with the church, not understanding that those are human beings that can't measure up to those kind of things. So that can throw them. But a lot of times it's the modernity thing, and they haven't kind of worked that out, and they think it's just a matter of belief. Well, I hold on to my belief in God, but I don't really need the church because this is all I have, and not understanding that our faith is a relational faith. It's not just vertical when we get that right with God, but it's horizontal. It's the sharing of the faith, and so being knit together in a family, not even a faith community, but a family, is really what he has in mind. Dealing with fallen away or somewhat confused or skeptical Catholics or Christians, I think that some of that you have to deal with. Well, what are their stated objections? And then if you're sharp enough and you can pick it up, there's often implicit problems that they have with Christianity and so on. And so I think that's kind of more tailored to the individual. I think in general, I think the book has a way of drawing people in. One of the gentlemen who's read the book already has told me that he intends to give it. He's never bought books for his kids, but he has a couple of adult kids who have wandered away from the faith in the manner you're talking about, Father. And
yes.
And he says that's what I'm going to give them this and just ask them to read it. Just read it through and, you know, get what you can out of it. And if you'd like to, we can talk. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. No, it does. It really does. Because each of us, as you point out in the book, needs to continue to learn the core truths of our faith. We should not take it for granted that we understand our faith as fully as we should, as we can, really as much as we can. And there, you write somewhere in the book, I don't remember which section it was, that we probably are surprised by how much we actually do know, how much we actually believe, until we begin to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, part of it is when we think about knowing other human beings, talk about my wife. I've been with her for 45 years. She's a great woman. And then every now and then there's some new things like, wow, I didn't see that. Well, I mean, when we're talking about a relationship with God, even more so. The richness and the depth of this, it's not just, you can get what you can get out of the formalities, but at some point you got to kind of have a kind of personal stake in a big way of beyond that. What am I looking for? How do I draw closer? Whether it's how do I serve better or how do I know him better? How do I articulate this better? How close do I feel? How intimate am I? So, it's a rich relationship.
And then there is the chapter on matters of morality. They're in the same vein what you were just explaining, we've been talking about. You write, in the modern world, there are many perspectives on morality, and sometimes these many perspectives lead to sharp discussions and to conflict and hostility. You can be certain of the reaction you will receive when you insist on the truth. When it comes to moral questions, problems, or situations, moderns generally hold the idea that morality is defined and decided by each person only, or mostly, or that morality is just a function of social norms, a matter of polling and opinion surveys that tap into general and collective cultural preferences. Either way, morality is a product, you write, of personal preference or merely a matter of social convention to many moderns. This individually determined morality, this quote-unquote moral relativism, as it is often called, is always lurking about below the surface of any discussion or difference of opinion in modern life. So we need to understand what's going on in our culture and our society around us, don't we?
Well, absolutely. And just understanding where that comes from. I mean, as we talked earlier, some of that comes from the the idea that all we are is matter and energy, and therefore everything is arbitrary beyond that fact. That the problem that relativists have, and this is, I mean, this is sometimes when we get in discussions or debates, sometimes we want to disagree. And, that's what you think. Let me give you this to think about. And that's sometimes okay. But I think a better, wiser strategy is to really ask more questions. I had an old professor, and he used to say, you know, first you beat them with their stick, then you beat them with yours. And what he meant by that was, tell me why you see it the way you see it. Because often there's a flaw in reason, or you'll get at some personal experience that is causing them to think that. And so it isn't so much a debate about morality as it is a revelation of their personal psychology that may be causing some of this. So getting them talking is, I think, the best way to start the conversation. I think if you go with the immediate debate, sometimes it ends up hardening positions rather than what you really want people to do, I think, is to think again about what's going on and give them a reason to reflect after they've talked to you rather than to be irritated.
And as you point out, its origin is God, the source of morality. Its origin is God.
Yeah.
And that morality must come from somewhere, something, some being, and it does. Comes from the intangible being, the creator of everything that is visible to our senses and to our minds, and that being is God. If we think we can have morality of any degree or amount of any breadth or depth without God, we are sadly and deeply mistaken. Our guest this evening has been F.X. Cronin, Frank Cronin, Dr. Cronin. We've been talking about his book, The World According to God, and the last chapter is on the heart of all matters. And I have so much that's underlined in this last chapter referred about love and truth and Jesus and love. Say a little bit about that in these last closing 2 minutes.
Well, I think love is the consummate experience of all parts of our being together, and knowing to really love. And most people, atheists, modernists, whatever, nobody denies the reality of love, though they can't really explain it based on what they think. The only way love can exist is if there's a God. The only way love in its full perfection and the fullness of what it is contingent upon the existence of a totally good and totally loving God. And so when we understand that, it doesn't mean that our rationality isn't part of love, because it isn't just emotion, but it's love is the kind of thing that reaches out to all aspects and facets of our being. And it's an encounter both from one human to another, but also with God. He is the perfection of love. He is the model for love. He is the maker of love. And so that's where he's going, because relationships is what he's after. He's always exhorting us to love him and reminding us that he loves us. And love desires time. Love desires intimacy. Love desires the best thing for all involved. So this is a God who is there to help us and to encourage us and correct us as any good parent would.
God is God, you write, and his nature is love, love in the fullest sense. God is love, and that means love is God's very nature, a love that is emotion, but more than emotion, a love that is the truth and is by its very nature the expression of all truth and all beauty, all moral perfection, all righteousness, all justice and mercy. Our guest this evening has been F.X. Cronin. The title of the book is The World According to God. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're such a wonderful teacher. As I sit before you in this interview, and as certainly as I will continue to reflect on various sections of this book. God bless you and all those you love.
Same to you, Father.
All right.
Thank
Good
you
night.
For your time.
So there is so much that can be said here. There was a section on love that love is the heart of all matters, the consummation of all things, the very essence of God. God's love is a love that harmonizes all virtue without denying it and without diminishing virtuous perfection to even the minutest degree. The heart of all matter is love, for it is perhaps the most visible and visceral of all the evidence for God. It proves that he exists and shows his nature, his character, his heart, his mind. Love in its holistic and harmonic perfection is outside the merely physical explanations. Love is knowable and experienced. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone, and come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Once upon a dismal day, Bob's ice cream van looked gloomy and gray. Although he had big ambitions, his socials lacked creative vision.
That bad?
Maybe vamp it up a tad?
I have an idea.
Bob launched Canva and got into gear.
Create the video in the vampire theme and make it the funniest meme.
It went viral. Bob's business, a revival. Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at canva.com.
At City Harvest, we believe no New Yorker has to go hungry. With your help, we're on the road every day, rescuing over 86 million pounds of nutritious food and delivering it free to millions of New Yorkers, transforming surplus food into sustenance, sustainability, and smiles, rallying thousands of New Yorkers to power a network of nourishment across our city. Feed good for our communities, our city, and our planet. Donate at cityharvest.org.